7654321.
You'll never have the sacred stone.
Oh, this you crazy mother.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Eric.
And I'm Riley.
And this is Beyond the Frame, a podcast where we talk about movies and we give our opinions and we talk about some of the deeper things that we think are important to bring up. This week, we're talking about The Banshees of Inisherin, which has a phenomenal title. I love that. Just like Colm says, he likes that name for his song. I also liked it. But before we get too deep into it, Riley, give me your first impressions of this movie without any spoilers.
Honestly, if it wasn't for this podcast, I don't know how long I would have gone without seeing this movie. Like, for example, the first time I watched Forrest Gump was 2 years ago. So when it comes to like movies that really aren't like an action horror thriller movie, it takes me a long time to get to. This, I would describe it as like an existential dark comedy. Mm-hmm. I thought it was phenomenal. I'll talk a little bit about the ending once we get to that point, but I think overall the movie had such a nice pace to it. The humor was excellent. It wasn't necessarily belly laugh humor throughout, but it was just consistently smirking, or the type of humor that like you look at your partner on the couch and you're just like, that's kind of funny. That was witty. I thought it was a good story. It was a nice character piece. Makes me really want to go to Ireland and look at some of the scenic stuff.
Right?
Absolutely.
It's so
gorgeous.
Beautiful. Yeah. It's like, I look to see if Inisherin is like an actual island. It's not, but these islands all do exist. They used three different islands to kind of like create the one island of Inisherin. And it was, I mean, it all looks so beautiful.
It's on the bucket list now.
Yeah, right? I think that the setting is also like, I hate to be like high school about this, but like it is kind of another character. It really is. It's like desolate. It's isolating. And it really plays into the feeling, I'm sure, that I think his name is, I can't remember the director's name. McDonough is like his last name.
Yeah.
But the director, I think really was trying to hammer home that with the visuals and with the characters and the story. It all just like comes together really nicely. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to add to that and say the time period also plays in that.
Oh, it does.
In that isolation, because there's a really great scene in the movie where there's a post office on this barren, empty island. And that's where the gossip is being exchanged. Yep. That is the flow of information, because this is 1923. There's no internet. There's no real communication except for letters and word of mouth. So the drama and everything that takes place on the island, that is the excitement. That is largely the world news for this tiny community.
Well, it's funny, like in that scene, Podrick has like such a funny interaction with the shopkeeper, because like he doesn't have any, he doesn't want to say what's going on in his life for obvious reasons. And she's just like pushing him and shit.
Yeah.
And you can just like, you can see the gossip and the drama and how quickly things can spread. It really embodies the whole small town feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's small town culture through and through.
It is. And we both grew up in small towns. So we know, we know exactly what that's like.
Yeah.
So I, for my impressions, I think you basically said everything that I had on my mind. I really, really, really enjoyed this movie. It's been on my radar for a while. I definitely would have watched this if we didn't cover it on the podcast, because I really was intrigued by the idea of this like character drama that was done by, I need to look up his name.
It's Martin. I don't know how you pronounce his last name. First name, Martin, though.
Martin McDonough is his name. So Martin McDonough is like, he just kind of all of a sudden became one of my favorite directors, because I didn't know what he directed. I love In Bruges.
Okay.
And I love Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. I did not make the connection that he had done those. But, so I was excited to watch this, to say the least. I really like his style. I really like the fact that he's writer and director on this. I think that he has a very specific way of writing dialogue and injecting the humor into it. And that worked so well in this. Maybe not so much in Three Billboards. It wasn't as funny. There were still funny parts of it. But I also really like that all of his stories have like this surreal aspect to them. So obviously in Banshees, it it very much manifests almost like an Irish folktale, weirdly. Like it's almost like a story that you would tell to like a kid about trying to be, or when you're trying to explain to them like relationships. I don't know. It was a parable that I saw drawn, and it's super surreal because like nobody in real life would ever cut off their nose to spite their face, but that's exactly what happens in this. At least I think so. To me, that's where the surreality comes from. And then I won't say too much about it anymore, but in Bruges has like this feeling of being in purgatory, and that's like definitely played throughout the script and also just in the setting of Bruges, because it's like kind of a weird, almost dreamlike feeling. Anyways, I really like this movie. I think that if you're on the fence about it, just go in blind. We say that for everything, but truly, I think this one, I had the escalation of this movie spoiled to me. I knew kind of what was going to happen. Yes. I didn't know what the ending was going to be, but I still thoroughly enjoyed it. I think I would have enjoyed it even more if I hadn't seen, if I hadn't known anything about it. But all that being said, what do you think about the setting and the idea of it being cast against the backdrop of the Irish Civil War? Do you think that was necessary for like to get across like the message, the underlying message of the film? Did you like that part?
I actually think this movie could be interpreted in a couple of different ways, and I think one of the ways you could interpret it is it wouldn't need the Civil War in the background. Like for me, when I watched the movie, the focus and my connections with what was happening and the importance of it didn't have to do with the Civil War at all. I understand that there was some symbolism with that, but for me, really the movie's a lot smaller in scope. For me, it's a movie about people who fail to really pursue their ambitions, and they get older and they just fill up with regret and they become bitter, spiteful people. And to me, that's what the island is. It's people who have lived in this tiny community for so long. They've forgone all of their other dreams or ambitions for other things. And what do they do every day? They go to the pub. That is, the pub is
their whole
more
life.
Or less the world. And Siobhan, for me, is the character that escapes from that monotony and says, no, I'm not going to stay here. I'm not going to let myself be filled with regret anymore. I'm going to go pursue what I want to do and be a librarian on the mainland. And she does that knowing that her brother is going to be left behind and he might become one of these people. And for me, at the end of the movie, this was Podrick deciding, okay, he might not be self-aware of it, but choosing to be one of these regretful people on the island who all they have left is their bitterness and their spite. And that to me is what a banshee is on the island. To me, the banshees are these people who are stuck here with nothing but bitterness and spite.
So they are literally the banshees in it. That's like, well, literally is not the right word, but that's what the banshees represent, are kind of these people.
I think it's just empty people who failed to live up to what they really wanted to do with their lives. And I think that's such a small town thing too, where you get, for some reason, one way or another, maybe you got a decent paying job while you're in your town of 12 or 1500, however small the town is. You get a good job, the money hooks you, and then suddenly 30 years down the road, you're like, man, I wish I traveled. I wish I did this. I wish I pursued this other career. To me, that's who the banshees are in this movie, and that's the way that I interpreted it. But I recognize the Civil War in the background, and that there's multiple other ways that you could interpret this movie.
You would say it's more of a critique on like small towns and like what they do to people or like how they can shape people.
I think that's what that was the important part of the movie for me. And
right.
I think that's,
yeah.
that's probably just because we both live in a small town. So
I 100% agree, because I think that is like the clearest through line that affects all of the characters, and that all of their stories relate back to how Inishirin is super isolated, and that they all grew up together. Essentially, they've known each other for so long. Yeah.
Oh, and I really like that one little sassy comment where it's basically, it's hard to find a partner too. Just
oh my God. Yeah.
Everyone knows each other, and there's, I don't know, maybe there's,
it's weird.
It's weird. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like there is a through line of being really weird. I mean, like, Dominic is the perfect example. Like, he is weird, and he's not. He's not. I don't think you're ever. You ever are like kind of drawn to dislike him. He's just weird. Because Podrick is constantly comparing himself to Dominic, even though they hang out the most. He takes it from the perspective of like, oh, well, am I the dimmest person on the island, or only like the second, you know, like to him. And he's obsessed with that, not being the, you know, dumbest guy on the island, when in reality, like, Dominic's actually like pretty sweet. And unfortunately, we'll learn what happens to Dominic when we talk about the end of Banshees. But I wanted to also ask you what you thought of just the idea that maybe this, or no, I guess to focus in on the relationship of Colm and Podrick, do you think that this was like a toxic escalation of like a fight, or do you think this is just like a fight that anybody could have and it just got out of hand? Like, do you think they both wanted to be in this? Is that part of their friendship? Yeah.
In terms of, do they, I'll break it down as two parts. In terms of, do they want this to be the case? Do they want this fight to exist and that's just part of their dynamic? I don't think so. I think Colm is pretty clear that he's done. Like, no sane man would chop off his fingers and go to the escalation that he did. In terms of, is this a toxic escalation? Maybe. I also think from the other side of things, I think it's natural to know why someone doesn't like you. I feel like some people are better at accepting that than others. And throughout the movie, Podrick really just wants to know, what did I do? And the explanation of, I just don't like you anymore. You're dull. I want different things. That doesn't scratch the itch.
You don't think it's fair for it to be that vague?
No, I think it's fair for it. I just don't think that
From Podrick's point of view. Yeah,
I think Podrick is always thinking, there is something more to this, and once I figure out what that is, I can remedy this whole relationship.
Yeah. Well, Podrick, it's almost like it's almost toxic on his side, because he defines himself as being really nice, and so he needs to know, like, what have I done? And that's funny, too, because there are multiple points throughout the movie where Colm's like, actually, I kind of like him like this. When he's like super drunk and emotional, it's the most interesting he's ever been.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of
which
toxic.
Just creates problems.
It does. Yeah. It does create problems. I will say, I think that, like, I read a few articles about like how this is, an interesting example of like a toxic male friendship. And, I don't know if I've ever been in a toxic male friendship to really say like, this is like, essentially a pissing contest of like how far one or the other would go. I don't think it really relates to it that much, though. I really think that it's like it is just like insular to those two, because they have had like, not that you couldn't extend it to other relationships, sure.
Yes.
I just haven't had that experience, but I think that it definitely is. Yeah, I don't know. I think it says some interesting things about like how far you're willing to go to prove a point. But beyond that, I don't think so.
Well, and I don't know much about the toxic escalation part. I really think it's just one person's inability to let go. And for Podrick, while we really don't get any insight into what the relationship was like beforehand, like it's alluded that every day at 2 p.m. they would go to the pub, but we don't actually see what their relationship is like beforehand. We pick up the day the friendship ends.
Yeah.
And I think Podrick, in addition to being the nice guy in town, his identity is defined by his relationship with Colm and having those daily, normal, nice conversations at the pub. And
just
without
chatting.
That, yeah, it's a loss of identity that he is struggling with.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I think that the toxicity thing, that escalation idea, does come from people who believe that, or at least have pointed out that it is the story of Banshees is very much a microcosm. And I hate that word. I hate that word so much. But it's like an allegory, a small-scale allegory for the Irish Civil War.
Okay.
And I'll only bring it up because I think it launches into what we can talk about. Like, I guess you kind of brought up the Banshees thing already, but I do want to talk about Mrs. McCormick. But before we get into that, this Irish Civil War thing, I think people thought that it was a toxicity thing because during the Irish Revolution, basically what happened was Britain and Ireland, they fought and they were both on the ropes in 1922, sorry. And basically Britain was like, here's a treaty. We don't want to fight anymore. Discuss it. And you can like make your own constitution and stuff like that. So they set about agreeing to the terms of the treaty, the IRA. Mm-hmm. And basically the treaty said that they were going to be a dominion of Britain, like Canada or Australia.
Okay.
So they would basically have governing power. I mean, we live in Canada. We know what that kind of ends up like. But there was a faction within the IRA that really wanted to be a free state completely. They thought the treaty didn't go far enough. And it basically, throughout the 1923 or 1922 to 23, there were just these escalations within Parliament of, you know, people stoking the flames in Southern Ireland and saying like, well, we actually think that we should be free. You know, it really started off as this little thing. They could have probably solved it if they had just stayed talking about the treaty. But yeah, it basically had neighbors and friends all fighting against killing each other, murdering each other in their homes over this treaty that probably wouldn't have mattered in the long run because the dominion status gave them way more power than just being subjugated by the UK. But some people thought that they needed that freedom. I don't know if maybe people were talking about, well, who was Colm? Like, was Colm the IRA proper, and was like was Podrick like the splinter faction? That gets too much into the weeds. But I think that when set against the backdrop of the Irish Civil War, I think it just is something else to think about. It lends it an authenticity. Yeah. It like, you know, gives you a little bit of cultural insight, maybe. I don't know if it really goes that deep, though, you know?
No, but it's a good point where it takes a very large political issue and what happened in real life and what's happening really just across the water from this island, and it makes it into a very intimate...
It's a very human story. You know, when you're talking, me explaining it to you, it doesn't sound very human because it's these faceless groups of people doing things. But when you really zoom in on Inis Sheeran and just these two characters, I think it got me to read more about the Irish Civil War. I think that, I think it was a great setting for it in
general.
It's
just... whether it's the Irish Civil War and it's just two neighbors not liking each other anymore, now you have something very similar where, for whatever reason, whether grounded in something very real or something relatively arbitrary, it's just two people who now suddenly don't get along, and it's an escalating conflict.
And it shows that it can be, like, the reasons for it can be arbitrary to the person, you know? Yeah, so I think that's... Yeah, I like that interpretation. I don't think I would go so far to break down every event as like being an allegory for for the Irish Civil War, which some people can do that. We don't do that here.
It's also interesting, too, because when you give me this political context about the fact that it's really just the fact that they were a dominion that's the problem. They want more political freedom. Mm-hmm. There just wasn't a lot of room for compromise in that argument, and there's not a lot of room for compromise in this Colm versus Padraic conversation, or this conflict, pardon me. And one thing Jesse pointed out when we watched this movie, and it's a really fair point, is, okay, why does it have to be cold turkey with Colm? Like, you want more time for your arts? Cool. Okay, maybe you can go drinking. Yeah, maybe you only go to the pub a couple hours a day, or maybe you only go drinking a couple days of the week. Like, it doesn't need to be, okay, I'm not going to ever talk to you again. Let me focus entirely on composing music. There could be boundaries on how often you see each other, when you see each other, and just communicating, hey, this is an interest I have now. I want to pursue it a little bit more. I just need time to do that.
Yeah. Yes. And it's interesting you bring up that, because I think people who took the toxic male friendship argument or line through line, you know, really pointed to that lack of communication as being like symptomatic of a toxic male friendship. So it's interesting that you bring that up, because it is kind of right. Like, he could have just said, look, we need to hang out a little bit less. You're not. My time is. But that assumes that Colm is thinking, like, my time is not worth more than your time. And he clearly thinks that for most of the movie.
Yes. So it's very interesting to see how many ways this movie can actually be interpreted. I think there's a lot of depths to it. And to be honest, I read a couple of reviews. I don't remember all the details about it, but there's people who interpreted this movie far different than the Civil War side of things, far different than how I kind of interpreted and what I took away from it. There's a lot of ambiguity to it. And because it's a character piece, and because you have so much freedom to impart your own background into these characters,
right between the lines.
It's interesting what you can come away from it with.
Yeah, I think that everybody who watches it will have a different opinion on like some of these like lower themes in the movie, because everybody, like you said, is going to have a different experience going into it. And I think that's what makes it so great.
What do you think about the characters in the movie? Do you have a favorite character?
I really liked Siobhan, and I really liked Padraic.
Oh, I thought Colin Farrell did fantastic as Padraic.
He was really good. What the heck is up with that? He's awesome.
Did Colin Farrell win an award for that? I almost feel like someone won best actor or actress for this movie.
That's a good question. Maybe should have looked that up before. I'll look that up right now. But that's it. Yeah.
He lent such a naive innocence to the character that just made him very charismatic. At least I found him very charismatic. Like, you disagree with what he's doing the whole time, and you get that sort of slasher movie feel where you're like, why are you doing this? This is not a smart decision. And he kept kind of pushing the boundaries a little bit throughout the movie. But I thought, as a whole, fantastic character. And I also agree with Siobhan.
Wait. Am I saying it right or wrong? Is it Siobhan or Siobhan?
Am I saying Siobhan? I think it's Siobhan.
Hold on. Well, I think it's Bond. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure I'm saying it right.
No, and it's worth noting, this is a very Irish movie.
It is.
It's very, in terms of the names, in terms of the slang, like...
Sullivan?
Well,
is their
way they
name?
Curse is different. Like, even the... I don't know if this is an Irish thing. It must be, just because of the nature of the movie. But instead of like having a question mark at the end of their sentences, instead they would just have like "yah" at the end. They would have a sentence and then "yah." Like, all these just unique.
It's super anachronistic. You know, I think that like really also just ties into the setting. It's just another layer to this whole idea of Inis Sheeran as like as a place.
Yes. Do we figure out if they won any awards?
They've got a lot of nominations.
Okay.
So they do have a Academy Award for Best Actor in a Leading Role, Best Actor in a Supporting Role, Best Directing, Best Picture. Like, it's up for
it's a lot.
Yeah, it did not. It got nominated for a bunch of BAFTAs. It did win the Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture. And then they also got, I think it was Colin Farrell who got the Outstanding Performances.
I feel like he got
Screen Actors Guild. Oh no! Wait, hold on. I'm looking. It's okay. Some of that hasn't happened yet. Excuse our ignorance, but I think that Colin Farrell did a really awesome job, like of being a foil to Colm. You know,
yes.
Colm was like very much on opposite ends of the spectrum from Podrick. I just to touch on Siobhan, I think that, and I didn't actually figure out if that's how I have to watch the video.
I think that's right. I think you have it.
Because it is spelled with a B, but the BH, is a V. But
yes,
either way, to touch on her, I'm glad that she got like the happy ending, and I think is a perfect example of somebody who just like actually walks away and just moves on with their life. So she was great to have in the movie. She had a lot of good moments of levity, and she was like the only sane person on the island.
I also just think in terms of performances, she delivered as good or potentially better for me than Colin Farrell's. I thought her actual acting was phenomenal, and she is definitely a person that I'm going to keep my eye on for later films, because it was excellent.
Yeah. I think there were three main characters in this, and they all had great performances. All of them are heavy-hitting performances in my mind.
I will say this, though. Brendan Gleeson is never bad in movies. He is always fantastic. But a lot of the time, his performances aren't eccentric. They're not loud. They're not like something that you're like, holy crap, that's really good acting.
They're pretty understated, usually.
It's very understated. It's always well done, but that's probably one of the reasons why I'm like, Carrie did a fantastic job. Colin did a fantastic job, because they were a lot louder of characters and they had those loud moments. Whereas even when he's throwing fingers at the door and he's doing seemingly dramatic things, he does them very understated. It's very quiet.
Yeah, he very much is the thinker
character
versus like Podrick. What did you think of Barry Keoghan's performance?
I thought it was good.
Yeah.
He's always a good actor. I will say his character in this movie reminded me a lot of his character in The Green Knight. I didn't see a lot of difference. They're both odd, slightly dirty, strange characters. I thought they were very similar. If you remember what he was like.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean, like thinking back to that character. We see him for so small of a time that it didn't even cross my mind. But now that you bring it up, and you said this kind of before we got into the podcast, that he's really good at playing like eccentric, kind of weirdo out there characters. Did you find that, like, I was a little concerned that he was going to do something bad, and I don't know if I had any idea of what bad thing he would have done, but it's like he's very unpredictable, I thought. But then as you get to know him, like by the end, I really loved his character, and he's such a little weirdo. But we all know that person who's like, you know, truly a good person but just comes off a little strange. I also really liked his performance. Do you have anything else to add for performances?
Not in terms of performances, but I don't know if we'll touch on this later with regards to other stuff. I just want to say for Dominic's character, he had there's maybe like four or five kind of, for me, heartbreaking moments in the film, or like moments of sadness. He owns two of them.
He does.
One of them being, hey, Podrick, you're not a nice person. I'm disappointed in you.
Yeah.
And the other one where he asked Siobhan out, and she said no, and he's he was just very honest about it. And he was, there was like a raw sadness on his face. And he kind of just like, okay, I'm going to go do that thing I was going to do over there.
Yeah.
Trying to just escape a very awkward situation. But I'm not sure how Dominic fits in the larger scope of the movie beyond just being of a slightly odd character in a small town. But those moments were really good. They were really sad. They brought, they added dynamic, I think, to both Siobhan and to Siobhan, pardon me, and to Podrick's characters and developed them a little bit more. But those are just two moments I just wanted to touch on very briefly.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that he, it's not really clear how he fits into the broader story. I'm not sure how he does either. I'm going to preface this with that. But I really enjoyed his conversations with Podrick. You get the sense that they are kind of the same. They're actually very similar characters. And that moment where he says, you know, you're not actually a nice person, it's gut-wrenching. It's like such a gut punch because you can see in Podrick that he really like actually values his opinion. He values Dominic's opinion. So all very good, very good performances.
And you just realized that moment, like Dominic truly looked up to Podrick.
He did, yeah. And was actually on his side from the beginning.
Yes.
Yeah. Like 100% was on Podrick's side. Wow. Yeah. This movie has a lot of there are sad moments, definitely. There's a couple of funny moments, but it's a lot of like melancholy, I think. That's what I got from it. It's like very much just like shrouded in this haze of everybody is kind of sad. It's kind of depressing. Inishirin is kind of a depressing place. You know, people have like they gossip about each other. Everybody's just kind of shitty. Yeah.
Welcome to small town living.
Yeah. I can't imagine living in a small town isolated on an island. At least where we grew up, we could leave if we wanted.
You could drive places.
Yeah,
yes.
But here you cannot.
No,
even if you could. Yeah, I mean, there's a horse and carriage, I guess. But
so we kind of beat around this point so far. But to me, this is one of the most unexplained, most uncharacteristic in terms of how normal people act. But during the movie, the conflict escalates to a point where Colm says, "Podrick, I don't want to talk to you anymore. If you keep talking to me, I'm going to cut off my fingers." He actually does that. By the end of the movie, he is a fingerless man, at least on one hand. Why do you think Colm went to that? Do you think it means anything? What's the importance of it to you?
I think that it is part of that surreal style that Martin McDonagh has. I think that the significance of it is that I think it really comes back to that old adage of cutting off your nose to spite your face. I think that thematically at the very least, in terms of the real granular parts of the story, like I truly think that it's a reflection of Colm's stubbornness. And his inability to communicate the boundaries. Like we said, he didn't set boundaries. He very well could have.
Yeah.
They both were they had functioning speech centers in their brain. They could have said something about it. And it really, it's there to one, reinforce Colm's character and then also add to the tragedy of it, because there are no other situations in which you completely ignore somebody unless they're dead.
Yeah.
And that, I think, it kind of is almost like he's treated like a ghost. Colm treats Podrick like a ghost in many ways.
I'm going to throw an idea out at you. And
okay.
Lay it on me. I don't know if this is something I've read and I'm taking it as my own idea, or if this is truly my own idea. It's one of those situations.
Okay. What's your idea? I'm going into this with
I imagine I've seen it somewhere before. One thing that people have is sometimes they go into something with these huge ideas. They believe that they're going to do something really important. They want to fulfill or complete some massive project, and the weight of that project is too much. It is an immense pressure. It causes its own anxiety, stress. It can cause depression. What if Combs' self-importance that he is going to be one of the greats, he is going to compose the next Mozart piece, he is going to have some sort of musical number that is going to be remembered for the next couple hundred of years, was too much, and cutting off his fingers was an out to escape that
pressure.
Yeah, to
stop. Yeah, that's a good point, because really, at the end, he's like, he has no fingers, and he's like trying to get these music students to play for him, when in reality he could have stopped this all from happening. So you're saying like the self-inflicted nature was like him basically having a mental break because he put too much pressure on himself.
Yeah,
and it was an easy way out.
It is an easy way out because now he literally can't play music.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that also like ties into something that I thought about his character is that he's super narcissistic. You know, everything is about him. And I don't know any like diagnosed narcissists, but like in my mind, like I think that like a narcissist would do that to to make it all about themselves. Because it turns everything into a conversation of, well, Podrick, you have to do something. You can't talk to him. He looks serious. He looks like he's going to do it.
Yeah.
That's such a narcissistic thing to do. It puts it all the onus onto Podrick.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, armchair psychology, but I do think that there is a bit of a through line there. And I think your point touches on that exactly.
To be honest, and I think you can go the other way too, because I feel like this is something I've read where someone might have asked the director, like, why'd this happen? And if I recall correctly, the director just said, really, I thought it was interesting. It was an interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
And you think of, apparently this is something common with artists where you have nightmares about being able or losing the thing that you could actually create art with. So, I don't know, maybe you're a composer and you lose your hearing, or, well, I mean, Sound of Metal is a movie all about that, or being an artist, like a painting artist or something, and
going
not being able to use your
or
hands, or, apparently it's a thing, and if I recall correctly, one of the reasons for this was really just because it's an interesting thing. It makes people wonder, it makes people talk about it.
Well, and he is a super deep character, so, like, I think that is just another layer to him as a person, and really, like, we're seeing like such a small sliver of this, of their relationship and of these two characters. I think that also helps helps sort of the character drama, you know, like you like you said, you kind of go into it and impart your own experiences and your own like ideas on these characters because it's left a little ambiguous.
Yeah.
Speaking of ambiguous characters, what did you think of Mrs. McCormick?
I have no idea.
Yeah,
what
do you think she represented?
I think the obvious answer was she's some sort of symbolism for death, because she predicts that two people are going to die. She's referred to as a ghoul. People are literally frightened about her.
Just kind of a witch, almost.
I've also read one thing where someone interpreted her basically as a symbol or an allegory for depression.
Because
there's apparently there's this one famous quote where, and this was definitely came from a YouTube video I watched, and I do forget who actually said it. But apparently there's this one quote where if you have depression, apparently you're supposed to invite depression in and not just ignore it. And it's a much more beautiful quote than that. But looking at how the characters respond to Miss McCormick, Siobhan actually invited Mrs. McCormick in and would have, I don't know, I forget what they did.
Tea,
whatever activity they did. But she actually invited Mrs. McCormick into her home, whereas Podrick would literally hide behind a stone wall to avoid her.
Avoid her. Yeah.
And there's this one really good line that Podrick has in the movie where him and Siobhan are basically theorizing why Combs is doing what they're doing, and one of the theories is he has depression, and Podrick says, okay, well, why doesn't he just push it down and bottle it up like the rest
of everybody,
us.
Everybody, yeah.
So one interesting theory was maybe Mrs. McCormick is some sort of symbol of depression. I think that's fair. I also think, like, just more clearly, being a symbol of death makes more sense visually, but I think thematically being a symbol of depression makes more sense based on the one explanation I've seen. But I don't really know. She's just a very strange character.
Yeah, she is very strange. Made me think of the witches from, like, Macbeth. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's like a... It's not exactly a through line, but it just like got me thinking because, like, Martin McDonagh, he does a lot of playwriting. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, there could be a Shakespearean kind of tie there. But yeah, no, I like the depression angle. I think that's way, way better and way more unexpected than her being like the representation of death.
Yeah.
I think that it is, you know, maybe she is the banshee because she's kind of like everywhere. She's always watching.
Yeah.
And like she doesn't say anything. Maybe this is super obvious because she literally predicts death and a banshee is, you know, they howl as they're the harbingers of death, right? So, yeah. So that's an obvious interpretation. I like the depression angle more. She kind of like also takes the, this is a thing that I saw in a YouTube video. Shout out Ryan Hollinger. I love his videos. He made the point that she's kind of like the narrator. She doesn't always say things, but she is always watching and silently sort of judging everything. And so kind of like a narrator would, even though they're not, their job is not to judge, but they still kind of are, you know, you would assume they would be judging because they're only human. So yeah, those are all really great interpretations. I think I would agree with the depression one because they do actually talk about it. And Colm never, he doesn't ever interact with her, I don't think.
No, she knows about the drama.
Yeah, but I don't think Colm, like, Podrick actually talks to her. Whereas, like, Colm, I don't think she does at all.
Yeah, I don't think so. You're probably correct on that. And you're also right that while she doesn't say a lot, she is in the background of a lot of the things that are happening.
Yeah.
And she comments on it occasionally. Like, while she doesn't speak with Colm, she does know the drama that's happening between Podrick and Colm. She seems to know the events that are going on in town.
Yeah, and there's that great shot of Podrick waving goodbye to Siobhan, and you can see somebody standing in the distance down the cliff from her, and it never focuses in on who it is, but it's clearly her because of her like walking stick thing that she has.
Yeah.
So she's very interesting. I don't know if I had any strong reaction to her character either way.
No.
I like that she was there. There were some funny bits with her.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it really just plays into the small town thing. There's all types of people, and she seems to be the most, maybe not bitter, but she like plays into the gossip, and she like always kind of looks like she's upset or like, you know, whatever.
She looks miserable.
She does look miserable. She looks like if you could embody the island of Inishirin and its people into one person, it would be her.
So, moving away from Mrs. McCormick for a second. Actually, no, this is directly tied with her, actually. So, why do you think Dominic died in the movie?
Why?
I feel like you could have removed his death and it wouldn't have changed anything about the scope. My initial flavor is maybe it means something towards how suffocating small life can be because it is implied that he committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a greater purpose to it? That was like one of the weirder beats of the movie, and I just didn't understand the point of it. And maybe there isn't a point.
Yeah, I think the interpretation of it being a result of how suffocating it can be to live in a small town, I think that's a fair interpretation. I also think you could take it one step further and say this is like what happens when small town life is allowed to, you know, take over your existence, if that makes any sense. Like, in the same way that, like, Podrick is consumed by this, like, really petty small town drama and goes so far as to burn down a house, like, you know, I think you could logically say that, like, Dominic might have seen that as, like, his only way out, because the one eligible bachelorette on the island said no to him, and just left. Because, like, I think maybe I'm jumping ahead of myself. Like, I don't think he did it because she said no. I think maybe he did it because she left. And it might not be directly tied to that. Like, you could also maybe say that maybe his dad killed him. Like, you know, like, I it's pretty ambiguous. They don't ever say. All you see of his dad looking at, well, I can't remember what his name, he had a name that started with a P, but like, all you could see is, like, just like one sort of, it's like one look. He looks at Dominic for a second.
Yeah.
And that's it. You don't see anything.
No, you are right to point out he's had a crappy life. He was abused, and I think it's also implied or stated that he was sexually abused. His best friend, I think that's at least how Dominic would interpret Podrick, as so using the phrase best friend. His best friend is now mean, and that's heartbreaking. And the woman of his dreams just rejected him and then moved away. There's not a lot left for him.
No, there really isn't. I think that really, if you look at Dominic, he's like the most tragic character. And it probably is supposed to be tragic, because you're looking at two people having this really petty beef, and then you see somebody who has real mental health problems and a real, really bad life, like a really bad life. And you see what happens to those people. Really, I think that, like, sums up all the things that I wanted to talk about. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to touch on.
No, I got one fun fact about the movie that Jesse wants me to put in the podcast.
Is it about the sweaters?
Yes, it is about the sweaters.
Morag also sent me that. Well, hey, I mean, please tell the listener about this fun fact.
Okay. I wasn't sure if things were happening at your house, so you need to wrap up quickly. Okay. So, one thing that when we were watching it, both before and after, because apparently Jesse did a little bit of research or found out this tidbit before we watched the movie, is apparently there is she's 83 years old or something. There was a very elderly sweater knitter in Ireland, and she knitted many of the sweaters in the film. And she's been knitting for 75 years, apparently, which, dear God, if I'm doing anything for 75 years, congratulations to me. And according to Vanity Fair, Brendan Gleeson loved the sweater so much that he is still receiving sweaters from her.
That's
awesome.
And
he'll write her, like, thank you cards. Random fun fact about the movie. So we just wanted to send our respect to the old sweater lady. Her name is Delia Barry. And
shout
hopefully
out.
She can keep knitting sweaters for another, I don't know, 15, 20 years.
There is somebody who has found their calling. That is somebody who is, like, actually leaving, like, this earth a little bit better than it was before.
That's a truly nice person. I cannot imagine a woman who has knitted for 75 years and is gifting out these sweaters to be a mean person.
Wow. That's amazing. What a cool story. That's a great... We didn't even talk about the ending, but, like, the ending is a bit of a non-ending in some ways. Like, you can interpret it in different ways, but, like, I don't think I have much to say about it. I think it's just the logical end of, like, two people who took it too far.
Yeah.
Like,
No. There's certain boundaries that once you cross, it's hard to go back from, and these two people escalated this conflict to such a degree that there is probably no going back from them.
No.
Maybe they'll be able to repair their relationship. It's implied that they're not.
No.
And that just sometimes happens. It's like a messy breakup. You may be friends afterwards, or you might not be.
It's also like adult friendships too, I'm sure. And, you know, it just gets complicated. So something for everybody in Banshees, I think.
And I just want to put it on the record that Jenny is officially the number one cinematic donkey. Above Donkey from Shrek and above Eeyore, I stan Jenny.
Jenny stan.
Yeah.
Wow, this is, we stan Jenny on this podcast.
Oh, it was the cutest donkey.
Sorry, I really should correct myself. There's like five main characters, including Jenny. Yeah.
No, Jenny doesn't get enough respect, and I did not see enough conversations about her and during my research. And I just wanted to lay it out that Jenny's an excellent donkey.
Can appreciate that. All right, so let's wrap it up. I rated this 4 out of 5 stars.
I would give it a 4 out of 5. I liked the pace of the movie. I liked the humor of the movie. I liked the characters in the movie. Was I completely satisfied with the ending? No, but I also think that's just because the movie's feeding me something that most other movies don't, and that's no clear resolution to it.
It's trying to challenge you, Riley. I'm not used to challenge you. You don't like to be challenged.
No, excellent film, excellent director. We've already mentioned Martin's previous works in Bruges.
Go watch Three Billboards, both solid, solid movies.
I would throw in Seven Psychopaths in there, too. That was one of my favorite comedies growing up.
Yep.
Just an excellent scriptwriter, knows how to do dialogue very well. Excellent dark comedy writer, too, if you're into that. So, yeah, no, I would give it a 4 out of 5 stars with you.
Nice. Okay, well, this is Beyond the Frame. You can follow us on Instagram. You can follow us, and all of these links will be in the video below. They'll also be in the show notes. You can go hit up our Patreon. We post some extra things. We just had like a 15-minute discussion before the podcast that I'll be posting there for patrons if you want to check that out. I thought it was pretty interesting. I don't know about you, Riley, but it was
pretty good. Next time we need to watch a truly bad movie so we can say, don't watch this one. Just to mix it up.
I feel like we've really, and you know, maybe that's just us picking good movies and we just, you know, have a sense for it. But if you want to watch more of our stuff, you can watch the YouTube videos on Midnight Radio. That's our YouTube channel. We're on all platforms, Apple Music, Spotify, whatever you listen to podcasts on, we are there. And you can go check out our Patreon. All the episodes are also posted there, and they become available to everybody a couple of weeks after they become available for patrons. So that's kind of it. Next time we are going to watch the viral cult horror film Skinamarink, which is actually was actually filmed in our backyards.
Literally,
but you know, close to us.
You know what? If you like experimental horror, give it a watch. And we'll see you at the next podcast.
Yeah. Everybody have a good week. See you in the next one.